Speaker of the morning is Ed Rubenstein. He is the Energy and Environment Manager at the University Health Network. He's been responsible for developing UHN's environmental management program since 1999. Both the UHN and Ed have been recognized in a number of areas for their leadership in the area of greening healthcare. By the Ontario Hospital Association, by Natural Resources Canada, Practice Green Health, and the Canadian Council on the Ministers for the Environment. Please help me in welcoming Ed Rubenstein.
Thank you, Sahir, and I'm very excited to be here. I realize I'm in the tough position of following Dr. Michael Gardaman before lunch, so I promise Sahir I'll keep this on time. The title of my presentation today is Going Green While Keeping Clean. And when I was approached several months ago with the potential of presenting at this conference, the suggested topic was Going Green versus Keeping Clean. I said, you know what, that's often the perception, but the message I really want to get across today that there's a lot of opportunity for collaboration and best practice between infection control and environmental management. So a brief overview of what I'll be speaking about today. The prime thing I want to speak about to start off is designing a clean and green hospital. We all know the frustrations we have. We share similar frustrations. We want to make it easy to clean. We want to make it energy efficient. And we want to make it water efficient as well. Once we have it built, the ongoing challenge is to operate it in a clean and green way. I've kind of positioned this differently under the three R's, reduce, reuse, recycle. But the underlying current to everything I'm going to be speaking about today is really a third bullet point at the bottom, which is creating a clean and green culture, which I think is the crux of everything we need to do. University Health Network is a big institution. There's 10 to 12,000 staff. We have a million ambulatory visits. We have 700, 800 beds. The Energy and Environment Office is about 2.5 people. And if anyone's interested, I can explain the half person later. But So it's really impossible for us, my office, and for infection control, which is substantially bigger, to be everywhere at the same time. So what we really need to focus on, and what I think Dr. Gardaman showed before and spoke about before, what I'll be speaking about, is really creating a culture where the institution starts taking care of itself in terms of clean and green. So with that in mind, the first thing I'd like to speak about is designing a clean and green hospital. So collaboration. So again, focusing on the collaboration. One thing we want to do is make a hospital that's easy to clean. Why is that? Well, clean, and please excuse my lack of technical terms when it comes to the infection control side of things, but it's a fewer places for bugs to live, right? So we know that if it's easier to clean, you can manage your infections much better. On the environmental side, the green side, green means you're using less water, less cleaning chemicals. Easier to clean is less time, less resources. Less resources is a green thing to do. The challenge we have, however, is that we need to try and build our hospitals and design our hospitals so they don't look like hospitals. More and more evidence is being supported that the so-called environment of care, the way a hospital looks, the way a hospital sounds, feels, smells, plays an increasingly important role, or at least we know it plays an increasingly important role on patient outcomes. So, gone are the days of white sterile corridors and things like that. But on the flip side, when we get something like this, it poses a bit of a challenge to us. So this is a fantastic-looking, award-winning institution in the Toronto area. Looks great. It's got the natural wood. It's got some trees and foliage in the background. We went for a tour there with some of our environmental services departments, our housekeeping managers, for something different. And the first thing one of our managers said when we entered the building is like, I'm glad I don't have to clean this place, right? So it looks great. This isn't the patient care area, but realizing that the more effort you have to spend in cleaning something, the less effort or the less resources you have for other environmental service or environmental protection things you need to do. So how do we balance something that looks great like this with something that the nuts and bolts of what we need to do as a healthcare institution? Closer to home, so this is our institution. So looking, this is actually a patient care room, and what you have there is a sconce light, or as we like to call them, dust catchers. So, realizing the patients will spend a large portion of time, sometimes days, weeks, in the hospital room. You want to make it as comfortable as possible. You don't want, again, the sterile lights, the fluorescent lights everywhere. But something like this does create work for our cleaners. So again, if they're spending time having to get on a ladder because you can't stand on chairs, there's health and safety to think about, to clean the light, especially if there's an isolation case involved or something to that effect, it's taking away, it creates work. It's not the most efficient design. Now, it's not always about great design. Sometimes it's not great design, but here's a very good example. This is, again, in our hospital. The toilet on the left, as you notice, is hooked onto the wall. It's a wall-mounted toilet. The toilet on the right is based on the floor. So I'll give you a guess as to which one is easier to clean. Obviously, the one that's wall mounted. And again, if it's easier to clean, there's less time. I mean, toilets are washrooms are notoriously not clean places. You can kind of see on the right hand side, the floor mounted toilet along the base. There's looks like there's some water staining or some leakage or something like that. Water is conducive to growing mold and other problems. So the toilet on the left does take a bit of planning. You can't just stick them in anywhere. You need to make sure that the walls are strong enough and they're planned in advance. But it's easier to clean. It's also going to be better for infection control because we're not worrying about water damage, not worrying about getting in those corners. Something I'll touch on a little bit later, if you look at the wall-mounted toilet, you see that the floor is actually rounded right up into the wall for a few inches. That's known as a cove base, whereas on the right-hand side, there's a straight, probably a vinyl sheet that goes down, and there's a kind of a crack there. So you can see that one on the wall mounted is what we could consider good design. It's nothing flashy, but it makes sense. It works from a patient perspective. They shouldn't see any difference as to how they use these toilets. So lesson learned along the way. Probably many of you have learned this lesson. We certainly did. We're in a certain position at University Healthcare right now, and we didn't just arrive there overnight. It took a lot of trial and error and changing attitudes and changing the way we think about things. And key when you're designing a healthcare institution, a doctor's office, a dentist's office, a hospital, is to choose the right materials for the right location. So things like cloth upholstery, leather, wooden floors, carpet, ceramic tiles will look fantastic in your house. Maybe you have them in your house. We really don't recommend them for patient areas because they're very difficult to clean. Non-patient areas, it's also a bit of a question mark. So we have when they built one of our new administrative areas where the corporate offices are, the CEO, they have a nice little sitting area, which was next to what was the only Tim Hortons in the hospital at the time. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful leather couches, several hundred dollars each. And what happens is when people grab their double-double and their Timbits, they go sit, they spill their coffee, crumbs and stuff like that. It was probably about a year later we had to get rid of those leather couches and chairs because they weren't cleanable. They weren't looking as nice as they used to be. So we don't want these things in patient care areas, but also non-patient care areas. Again, we have to keep in mind that if we're spending time cleaning these things, it's going to take away from what we really want our cleaners to be doing. So sticking with the lessons learned, things to keep in mind when you're choosing the right materials for the right location. So really have to know what's taking place in the area. So if it's a patient care area, is it clinic versus inpatient? Is there a possibility of hemodialysis, for example, being done there, where there's stronger chemicals being used the hemodialysis solutions? Is it patient care versus administrative area? Cleaning products, is it a patient care area? You are likely going to have to disinfect it at some point as opposed to administrative area where usually just cleaning is called for. So that will really have bearing on the types of materials you choose. And also the potential for heavy traffic. We want our hospitals to look good. So if it's an entranceway where you're going to have hundreds, thousands, millions of people coming in throughout a year, you really have to choose a material that's really durable, something that's easy to clean as well, and something that's conducive to good infection control procedures. Something that's coming up more and more with hand hygiene is that we have the solutions by the door. Many hospitals probably have that. And we're finding in many places where, you squirt a little bit on your hand, some drips on the floor, it's eating away at the floor. So that's where we're actually learning now that, maybe in certain locations we need better hand hygiene centers or we need better flooring materials chosen for those areas. Sticking with making it easy to clean and building materials, so there's a myth out there that natural flooring materials such as linoleum, bamboo, wood, and stuff like that create a mold risk. And the actual reality from what we found is that it's not the material itself that creates the mold risk, it's the damp conditions. So we use linoleum throughout UHN in many different areas. The key for us is the proper installation, the key is proper cleaning, the proper maintenance of any floor. It's not just linoleum. You could have the beautiful vinyl floor. If they don't seal the seams properly and water gets underneath, you've got a mold problem. You could have, type of wall product, and if there's a leak and water gets into the wall somehow, you've got a mold risk, you've got a mold problem. So you can use natural flooring materials. I wouldn't recommend it for patient care areas, but for, common areas, administrative areas, waiting rooms, anywhere where you really want to take people's mind away from the fact that they're being in the hospital, they can be considered. But you have to ensure that you have proper installation, and you need to make sure that appropriate cleaning and maintenance is being done of that material. Not just flooring, wall products, upholstery, all kinds of things. Another myth, and over the years, green has become much more popular, as has infection control. We had SARS and H1N1. A lot of people are talking about infection control things. And more you're seeing products available, all different types of things that have some sort of antibacterial treatment. It's either a coating or it's embedded in it. So what we found from our evaluation, and this is working very closely with our infection control team, is that that really is not the most important factor, even sometimes a factor at all when you're determining which products to use. It really is making sure you have the right material for the right place. Many times these antibacterial claims need to be validated. I mean, anyone can say they've got antibacterial whatever and they're whatever. It doesn't really mean anything. You need some validation. Sometimes it's a conjunction with proper cleaning processes. Sometimes it just means they've got a coating on it that, you know, if you're putting in a floor that could last 10, 20, 30, some of our floors have been around for 50 years, that antibacterial treatment on top of the floor is going to be long gone in a few years, especially in a high-traffic area. So it's something to look at, but it's not really the most important factor when you're looking at proper materials. Again, you want to make sure you have the right material for the right place and you've got the right maintenance and cleaning procedures in place. Lessons learned. So this picture didn't come out the best, but looking at types of flooring. So on the left-hand side, you have one area of our hospital, an older area where you've got tiles, one-by-one vinyl tile. You can't see it too well, but there's cracks between every tile. On the right-hand side, you've got a sheet flooring, a continuous flooring. It does have seams, but these seams can be sealed. And that's in the newer part of the hospital. So obviously we've learned that tiles are not the best for infection control. They have cracks that can catch dirt and water. It's very difficult. You wax them, but there's a lot of wear and tear on these floors. Very easy for water to get under a tile or dirt to get in, especially if you're in an area that has snow and stuff like that, and salt is very, very harsh on some of these floors, even if you have a protective coating on top. On the flip side, they are easy to repair. So with a big piece of flooring, sheet flooring, you have to either cut out a piece or replace a big chunk. These tiles, you can take out the one or two tiles that need to be repaired and put new ones in, if you can match the colors, that is. So we don't advise, or these are not advised for patient care areas. The sheet floor, on the other hand, has seams. They can be sealed, very effective. You can do that cove base I mentioned before where the floor kind of rounds up to the wall. So that's very good for cleaning staff to get a mop or a broom in there and make sure no dirt is caught in the corner. It's also very important for patient care areas. If you're still using mercury in your hospitals, which I hope not too many are, that's a great place for mercury to go and hide if there's a mercury spill right in the cove there. And that gets very, very expensive and very difficult to clean up. Something to keep in mind when looking at flooring options is to look for waxless flooring options. So waxing is the superficial coat that's put on. Some people do it because they think it looks good, a nice shiny floor. It does protect the floor in some cases, but it's a lot of work to do that, especially in patient care areas. I've seen areas in ICUs, for example, where they had wax when they first built the area. You're never going to get in there and have the time to be able to strip that wax off the floor and re-wax the floor. It's just far too busy, and you don't have the length of time. Very often, the chemicals you're using are not the best, so there's odor issues as well, so they're not good for our staff, they're not good for our patients. So there are waxless options out there, many different ones. There's superficial coatings, they're built into the materials, there's stuff that's embedded in it. Really need to do your research, talk to your colleagues, see what's being used in other areas, find what works for them, and look for something with a track record or if it's something new, make sure you get your environmental services people to be involved in testing it. So there is a challenge I have to speak about when it comes to making it easy to clean, and it's called PVC or polyvinyl chloride. So PVC is a wonderful material. It's easy to clean. It's relatively inexpensive. It's versatile. It's in everything. It's in flooring. It's in pipes. It's in our shower curtains. It's in our baby toys. Very easy to work with. However, as you can see on the right-hand side, this is just one group, but the Healthy Building Network says PVC is the worst plastic from an environmental health perspective. So here we have a separation of what we want to do to make something easy to clean. Environmental services love this. When we want to make something that's green. The concern with PVC, to be honest, is not so much in the use of the PVC itself, but it has to do with the upstream, the manufacture of PVC, and disposal of PVC downstream. There's more and more studies that show that some of the additives being added to some of these PVC things we have can be harmful to us, can be dangerous. There's many recommendations that PVC should not be used for children's toys. Phthalates, which are added to PVC to make it malleable, things like that, have endocrine-disrupting properties, which are of concern. But this is really a challenge we have. So we have some areas at UHN where, do you know what, the only floor we're able to use because of the way the area is being used, what our housekeeping department wants, and what we need in terms of cleaning and stuff like that is PVC. There are alternatives out there. There's more and more. But going back to some of the other things, we really need to validate some of the claims of these other materials to make sure they work. So that's about designing a hospital that's easy to clean or a healthcare institution that's easy to clean. We also want to make it energy efficient. And here I'm going to start off with another challenge, HVAC, so heating, ventilation, and air conditioning. So key to, I mean, you know better than I do, but key to good infection control is lots of fresh air coming in, high number of air exchanges. You know, for an operating room, you're going to want more than for an inpatient area, and sometimes 100% outside air. So making sure that if there are any pathogens in the room, they're being removed as quickly as possible. On the green side, that's not very energy efficient. You know, it takes a lot of energy to move that air. Big fans are required to suck the air in, move it to where it's needed. You need to condition the air. You have to heat it. You have to cool it. You have to add humidity. You have to take out humidity, all kinds of things. Usually in a hospital, you find that of all the energy use, about 50% is going to be related to HVAC, heating and ventilation. So to put that in a bit of perspective, at UHN, we spend about $20 million per year in utilities. Roughly $10 million per year is meant for moving air around, providing heat, ventilation, and those sort of things. So this is a challenge. I mean, this is something that's definitely a challenge, but it doesn't mean we can't work together and collaborate on this. How do we collaborate? Well, it's something called heat recovery. And very simply, what it means is before you exhaust this air, so you spend a lot of energy taking this outside air and cooling it down for the operating room and adding humidity or whatever, before that air is exhausted, you know, after it's barely been in this room, if you have 20 air exchanges, it's been in that room for about 2 or 3 minutes, see if there's a way that you can recover some of the heat or cooling or humidity from that air and put it into the air that's being drawn into the hospital. There's a couple ways we can do this. There's something called a heat wheel. Very simply, it's a wheel, and I've seen one of these. I was in a hospital out in Alberta, and I think the wheel was two stories large. A very impressive thing to look at, but basically it's a wheel that turns, and you can see you've got the conditioned stale air that's coming out on the left-hand side with the red arrow. And then and as that wheel turns, it's taking some of the heating or cooling or the conditioning, putting it back into the air that's being drawn into the hospital, saving energy. It can be a very effective way of making sure that you're making the most use of that energy you've put into that air. There's a myth that there's the potential for cross-contamination. So you may think that, you know, air coming in is going to cross-contaminate with fresh air and stale air. Stale air going out is going to cross-contaminate fresh air coming in. The reality is that heat wheels are already common use in hospitals. It's allowed by the Canadian Standards Association standards. And it's most often used where you're drawing in a lot of fresh air. So, I mean, research laboratories and things like that are key areas. With that in mind, there are certain areas you may not want to use a heat wheel for. So negative pressure isolation rooms are usually our infection control department doesn't like the heat wheels used in those areas. But in an isolation room, that's a relatively small volume of air. I mean, you think of all the air, you know, the square footage you have in a hospital, a lot of air is being drawn in. Isolation rooms are going to be the small amount of air. So there's different areas that where a heat wheel might be more appropriate to use. However, that still makes you more nervous. There's another way of doing it. It's called coil loop recovery. That's very simple. You have your stream of stale air or conditioned air, and you use a coil of liquid, a loop of liquid, glycol, water, whatever, and that captures some of the heat from that air going out, and it takes that, pumps it along the loop, and goes through the air coming in, captures some of the heating or cooling. No risk of cross-contamination between the airstreams. However, it's not as efficient as a heat wheel, but it's something to keep in mind. You can also do this with wastewater as well. I mean, we pump a lot of hot water, and we use a lot of hot water in hospitals, go straight down the drain. You can actually recover some of the heat from that hot water, use it for preheating some of the water, your cold water that's coming in from your municipal feed before it gets heated up to hot water again. Looking at a future collaboration, there's something called displacement ventilation, which is on the horizon. So this is my interpretation of how it works. So on the left-hand side, you have what I call old-fashioned overhead ventilation. We probably have something like this in this room here, where you have a fan or a vent on the left-hand side here pumping air in. You also have a fan on the right-hand side in this picture, the right-hand arrow there. Pumping air out. And what happens below is that the air gets mixed up, right? So it's counting on the air, the pressure of the air coming down, movement in the room to mix up the air, disperse the heating, the cooling, and those kind of things. However, you can see that there's a lot of air mixed up. And displacement ventilation, it's a slightly different concept. It uses the natural property of air heating and rising and fans and those sort of things, where air is pumped in at the bottom of the room and it rises to the top where the stale air, the used air, if you will, is drawn out from the room. Now, it's still something that's being looked at, but the initial findings are that it may allow for fewer air exchanges without reducing infection control requirements. So fewer air exchanges mean you have bringing less air in. It's also meaning that you're having to heat it less, cool it less, a lot less energy is being used to condition that air. The early results are promising, so you can see in the bottom there that the early results are showing that using displacement ventilation and using 4 air changers per hour found that there's better particle control than doing standard ventilation or old-fashioned ventilation at 6 air changers per hour. So the concept behind that is that in the old-fashioned ventilation, you may have a particle of a pathogen or something that's on you or on a patient on your hands. That air is going to blow it all over the place. Higher chance that it's going to land somewhere where you don't want it to land. With displacement ventilation, it's more likely that the particle flows straight from the bottom up. Less chance that if there's a pathogen on something that it's going to land where you don't want it in a person or things like that. However, there's more research that needs to be done. This needs to be validated. So there's a group called the Healthcare Ventilation Research Collaborative that's working on it. I haven't had a chance to look to see if they had any findings lately. But again, it looks very promising and looks a way where we can manage our infection control requirements and also make sure that we're reducing the amount of energy we need for hospitals. And hospitals, I should point out, energy is huge. And when it comes to public buildings, municipalities, academia, universities, schools, and hospitals, hospitals have the highest energy intensity of all those buildings. We use a lot of energy for our heating, our cooling, our diagnostic equipment. All of this takes a lot of energy. Making an institution water efficient, so a very easy collaboration here. Hand-free sinks are fantastic. So on the clean side, you know, fewer hands touching the sinks, right? So you have people washing their hands or not clean hands, touching the handles and stuff like that, a transfer point for pathogens. On the green side, very often in hospitals, people get grossed out by touching the sinks and things like that, so they may not turn off the water, or they may just kind of keep it running and use a piece of paper towel and half turn it off and things like that. So hands-free sinks really reduces the chance of people touching things with infected hands or passing on infection that way. It also reduces the chance of people leaving the sinks on. What's really exciting in these things is that there's a new line of these hands-free sinks with the occupancy sensors or the motion sensors that are self-charging. So typically you have to put in a battery or it has to be wired to your electrical system, both of which pose maintenance problems. You know, wiring means you can't really put one in everywhere because you need to have the electricity there. If you're trying to do a retrofit or, you know, changing something, if there's no electricity there, it's added cost to bring it there. Batteries need to be changed, so someone needs to remember to change that battery. And if, you know, most hospitals, you know, maintenance and housekeeping are very tight budgets, you know, don't have the manpower they need for these things, so it can often go without happening. There are two kinds of hands-free, self-charging hands-free faucets that I've had experience with, and both work fairly well. One simply has a solar charger, which uses the ambient light, so you've got the fluorescent lights in the bathroom, because people aren't going to the bathroom in the dark, hopefully. And it just uses that to provide the small amount of charge and charge up the battery at the same time to make sure that sink keeps running. The other one is also pretty ingenious. It has a little bit of a turbine in the water stream. So as the water flows out, it turns a turbine and charges up the battery as well. Both of them work very well. We're actually installing it in one of our hospitals, Princess Margaret Hospital. We found it was a perfect application for something like this. And I've used them myself in different offices, and they haven't seen any problems with them. So it's something to keep in mind. Okay, so we've designed our clean and green hospital, and there's probably a few more details we could get into, but those are the main things that we've encountered over the years. Now we need to make sure that we built it, we operate it in a way that's clean and green at the same time. So, I've positioned this on the reduce, reuse, and recycle, the three R's. So one thing we want to try and do is reduce the amount of biomedical waste. And when I'm saying biomedical waste, it's a bit of a technical term. There's a lot of myths and misconceptions around hospital waste. Biomedical waste, in Ontario, we have a guideline C4 that regulates or specifies what's considered biomedical waste. There's a CSA standard as well, which I mentioned. But there's a myth out there that I've found in, you know, working with different institutions, that all isolation room waste needs to be disposed of as biomedical waste. So you have a patient who's being isolated for C. diff, MRSA, even for TB, and they say, well, this stuff has to go out for incineration, this stuff needs to go out for autoclaving. When in fact, the legal requirement is that much of this waste, probably all of this waste, does not need to go out for special disposal procedures. You need to make sure that the infection is contained within that room. It's not spread from patient to staff or staff to patient, or patient to patient. But once that waste leaves the room, if routine precautions are practiced, you know, the stuff is bagged, nothing leaves the room, there's no need for that stuff to be sterilized in any way. Sterilizing biomedical waste is much more expensive. It could be 7 to 10 times as much as throwing out regular garbage from a cost perspective. Also, you think of the energy that's needed for autoclaving, which is the preferable way of treating waste, or incineration, the emissions associated with it. Sterilizing waste is not good for the environment. So, I mean, and this is a, this is one of the collaborations we've had at UHN, where we had, you know, one of our hospitals, there's three hospitals, the Toronto General, Toronto Western, Princess Margaret Hospitals. One of the hospitals, for whatever reason, were resistant about changing the practices in the isolation rooms. They wanted to make sure that all the waste in the isolation rooms was going to, into yellow bags and being sent out for autoclaving. And I tried for years and years and years to say, you know what, we don't need to do this. You're wasting your money on this. You know, it's environmentally, it's not good. But for some reason, they're really resistant. Where we really had the change is when I started working with infection control, and they actually took a bit of lead on this, and they said, you know what, you really don't need to do this. There's no infection control reason for making sure this waste is sterilized. All you need to do is make sure you practice routine precautions, make sure the staff are properly trained, they're reading the stop isolation signs and all those sort of things. But you don't need to send it out for autoclaving. And by combining together and making sure that the staff had the proper training, the staff had the proper signs and all those sorts of things, I think we reduced the isolation waste the biomedical waste coming out of this hospital by 15 or 20%. Because, you know, in any given day we can have, you know, dozens of patients who are under isolation. And if all that waste is going out as yellow bag waste, it's a considerable drain on resources and time and things like that. So, you know, again, MRSA, VRE, C. diff, you know, there's very few wastes that need to be actually handled as biomedical waste when disposed. And most of those wastes, if you have a case like that, so it could be something like Ebola, it's front page use usually, right? The one exception is sometimes we have a patient with suspected CJD. That kind of waste, we make sure it's appropriately disposed. But for most of the other things you're going to see out in the community that are day-to-day, I'll say, really don't have to handle them any differently than we do with regular waste when it comes to disposal. There's the CSA, the CSA standard there, handling of waste materials in healthcare facilities and veterinary healthcare facilities, CSA Z317.10-09, recently updated. There's also, I mean, many jurisdictions, Ontario is one that has legal requirements, that's what you're going to have to look at. Some areas do not have legal requirements, so the best practice is the CSA standard. But it's key that you check with your local requirements, and that includes your city bylaws, your municipal bylaws, also includes what your waste handler is willing to accept, right? You need to make sure that they may have the conditions when they haul waste that they can't take isolation room waste or they have concerns and stuff like that. So it's one thing to say this is the law, this is what we're able to do, but you also have to be really conscious of what some of your local requirements are. Oh, okay, reducing toxical chemical use. So back in the day, there was the myth that everything in the hospital needed to be disinfected. You go in the hospital, it smells like bleach, everything is whitewashed and sterilized. The reality is only some hospital areas need to be disinfected. You know, we when I got to UHN, we were disinfecting a lot more things than we are now. But more and more, it's being found that what's really important in managing infection control is that, yes, you do need to disinfect sometimes, but good housekeeping practices are equally as important. So where we've had good success in the collaborations, where we had joint assessments between our IPAC team and environmental services to say, Where do we need to disinfect and where do we need a good cleaning? So the good example is if you've got a floor caked with mud and you kind of wipe Virox or something over it and it's still caked with mud, you haven't really done anything. If you take the step to clean that floor, get rid of the mud, you've actually gone a long way to removing the pathogens and the source for infection. And this is the last bullet point there needs a bit of an explanation, but the choice of cleaning products, whether conventional or green, has little or no impact on infection control. So there's many different products out there for cleaning floors and stuff like that. It's not so much important which product you use, and there's, you know, sometimes your housekeepers or your environmental services people have their favorites, but you have to make sure you get the right product that works for you and that you're using the right product in the right location. So what you want to avoid is one of our lessons learned, where we may be paying a premium for disinfecting chemicals where we actually don't need these kind of things. So one of the examples we had is in UHN, we were actually disinfecting our floors, using something a little bit stronger than the cleaning product, more costly cleaning product. There was health and safety concerns for the staff who were doing this cleaning. And infection control said, you know what, there's really no point in most cases for disinfecting a floor. You may spend, you know, half an hour disinfecting the floor. As soon as that first person walks through that floor, and hospitals are 24/7, as you know, that floor is not sterile or is not disinfected anymore. So what we actually did is we went from using a harsh cleaning product, a disinfectant, to a third-party certified green cleaning product, right? And had very little effect, no effect, on our infection control rates and practices. Yes, there are some times where you need to disinfect floors, but in most cases you don't, and that's where the best practice, the joint collaboration of where you need to clean with what is really important. Greening healthcare has been around for a while. I've been doing it for 10 years, and it's been the field's been around for about 12 or so years. Great group out there called Practice Green Health. There's also a group called Healthcare Without Harm, and there's the Canadian Coalition for Green Healthcare. But Practice Green Health has the 10-step guide to green cleaning implementation. Very practical. You know, very often when I go to green hospital or healthcare conferences, it's their infection control people there who say, you know what, we want to green our hospital. So it's very not uncommon for infection control to take a lead in these kind of things. And the information is all there. A great organization for you to look into if you're interested. Future collaborations. This when I put these slides together, this was a future collaboration, but I now think it's an active collaboration. Ecologo is a third-party certification for green products, so you can, if you pick up something with the Ecologo label on it, you can be pretty sure that their green or environmental claims have been certified by someone who's not the company themselves. You're probably aware of the term greenwashing. It's not the actual washing, but it's really companies having a loose interpretation of what green environment or environmentally friendly means. So they may say something is future friendly, or they may say something is good for the environment. Those are so-called unregulated terms. They really don't mean anything. Something like Ecologo is third-party certification that said, you know, this product says it's non-toxic. You can rest pretty sure that it's non-toxic. So there's a new Ecologo certification for hand sanitizers. The main criteria for that is the less harmful raw materials, what's going into the product itself. They should have some bio-based content, which means you're not just looking at using petroleum to make these things, but you're looking at corn or whatever. And the packaging should be recyclable. There's a link there, but I think it was about 2 weeks ago I got an email from one of our infection control managers at the hospital said, hey, we have the new hand sanitizer, and it's now Ecologo certified. So things are changing quickly. And again, I mean, this is a way for you to kind of vet out if someone's saying this is green product we have here. You really want to look for something like Ecologo certification to make sure that the claims are valid. Another thing, and this might be a little bit controversial, but looking at future collaboration are microfiber mops. So microfiber is a great material. It's synthetic ultrafine fibers. I think my shirt might be microfiber. It's great. And the property of the microfiber, and you can kind of see a representation there where you have microfibers on the left, and you can see it's kind of this position allows for more uptake of water and particles than the traditional mop, which is the gray circle on the right. So if you can absorb more water, more particles, you know, and studies have shown that you actually need less water for cleaning floors or cleaning whatever, which means you need less chemical, which is the green side of it. However, there are many claims of reduced bacteria through use of microfiber, and these, as far as I can tell, and talking to infection control at our hospital, still need to be validated. So there's different types of microfibers out there. There's different processes out there. So you really need to take a step back. There's a lot of potential for this, for both green and clean, but the infection control side of things really need to be validated. So, you know, do you have to do twice, wipe twice, or do you have to change your cloth every three rooms or something like that? These are the kind of questions that still need to be answered. Which chemicals do you need? How much water do you need? How often do you need to clean? These are the kind of things that we're still looking at validating. Also under reduction, potential future collaboration are what I've called, in quotes, next generation hand dryers. So hand dryers are something in hospitals. I've read studies. We probably see things where they harbor bacteria. You know, it's a moist, warm area, perfect for dust to collect, perfect for bacteria to grow. On the other hand, you have the paper towels, which is not the greenest thing because, you know, people take paper towels. They'll use them for anything. They'll use them to open the door, to close the door, to dry their hands. They'll grab 10 handfuls of it, whatever. I don't know why they use so much paper towel. So these so-called next-generation hand dryers claim to use less energy than warm air hand dryers. They actually don't dry. They don't use heat to dry it, but they'll push your hand off. There's one example there. If you ever haven't tried them, they're kind of neat just for the geeky neatness factor, because they kind of blow your hands up and they make your skin all wrinkly and things like that. So they claim to use less energy than warm air hand dryers. You don't have to use paper, which is a big resource. Paper is also something that, you know, takes time for staff to continue to replenish paper towels. But they do make some hygiene claims that still need to be validated. So, you know, there's concern that, you know, if you have people touching these hand dryers, you know, I put my hand in, you can see, and this is just one example. I don't want to stick on this one manufacturer, but, you know, if they're touching this, is this a potential place for potential area for cross-contamination? They claim to be antibacterial, have a coating or something in it, but again, going back to earlier claims, if this hand dryer is going to be in an institution for many, many years, is that still valid? So these are things that still need to be validated as we move ahead. Also reducing energy use. So again, energy is probably the biggest environmental impact in a hospital. And one thing we're able to do is schedule our heating and ventilation. The CSA standard does say we're allowed to turn down the ventilation where it's not needed. So you have an operating room where you need 20 air changes when it's in use. When that operating room is empty, you can turn down the ventilation. You don't have to pump as much air, heating and cooling into an operating room if it's not in use. This, again, is all in the CSA standards. Special requirements for heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems in healthcare facilities. And this really is a collaboration because, I'm not pointing fingers at infection control, but usually, I mean, you have a facilities manager saying we want to turn down the ventilation. Where they are going to get pushback is from infection control saying, no, we need 20 air changes, and that's that, and that's final, right? And then if you design your ORs where you're not able to turn down the ventilation, those ORs are going to be running at full ventilation forever and ever and ever until you change your ORs again. So this is where, you know, really actually maybe I should have put this slide in the design stage where infection control needs to be on board, you know, make sure they understand, you know, you're going to have concerns and questions, make sure those are addressed, but really consider these when you're designing your hospitals and running your hospitals. Filter changes. So this is another collaboration. So filters, we have filters all over the hospital. We have filters with the air coming in to take out, you know, in Toronto we have a problem with smog day, so making sure the smog is taken out and particles. We had an issue with one of our new areas. I don't know if I should say this, but new operating rooms, and we had a hot dog vendor on the street below, and we were getting hot dog odors coming at the area. Yeah, so I think it was, A, distracting to the surgeons, and, you know, patients waking up really hungry as well. Similarly, we had one of our air intakes by one of our parking garages, so we had diesel fumes, which is a little bit more distressing. Hot dogs are pretty distressing for some people, but diesel fumes are a little bit more distressing as well. So filters are very important for the air coming in, also very important for air going out, especially in areas where we may have potential pathogens going out. Making sure those filters are changed regularly is very, very important. Make sure that the filters are working properly. A filter that's full or clogged is not going to filter as efficiently as it could. Also, a filter that's full or clogged is going to require more energy to push the air through. So another collaboration is making sure that between, you know, offices like my own and infection control, making sure that our maintenance departments are changing the filters appropriately when is needed. They're not waiting for a filter to fail. They're not, you know, they're being proactive about it and doing a bit of preventive maintenance. Another reduction we want to look at doing is putting pharmaceutical waste down the drain. So this is a very popular way of throwing out pharmaceuticals in hospitals, at home too, unfortunately. So there's a lot of evidence that pharmaceuticals are showing up in our water streams. There's a lot of studies, you know, you get drinking water in many urban centers and you're going to find all kinds of hormones and birth controls and all kind of things like that. Not necessarily all coming from healthcare institutions. Actually, a large percentage may be coming from people who, you know, you take your medication, you don't metabolize all that medication, you excrete it, goes into the sewer system. Many of these chemicals won't break down. They get taken up into a freshwater intake. However, there is a clean or infection control reason for making sure these things are not going down the drain, especially in our hand-washing sinks. So if you have something that's an IV solution, it's in sugar or water, something like that, if this stuff is going to go down the drain, you're likely going to get a film forming of it on the drain, and it's a perfect medium to prevent to have biofilms forming, right? So you've got, you know, sugar water, bugs love it. It's on the, you know, on the side of the pipes inside. Very difficult to clean those pipes, as we found out. So it's, you know, if we can avoid putting these things down the drain from a clean perspective, you reduce the chance of those things, the bugs that grow in those drains, coming back out and haunting us later. There's also, and this is something that's getting more and more in play, is that, you know, we're dumping IVs. We have a lot of antibiotics and IVs. The issue of antibiotic resistance, right? So when you put something down the drain, you know, it's for many people, it's out of mind, out of sight, but there are actually bugs down the drain. There's bugs that are meant to destroy the sewage, the things that we're supposed to flush down the drain. When you put these antibiotics down, you're exposing these bugs to these antibiotics, and there's a bit higher chance of developing antibiotic resistance. So two very valid reasons, I think, for not putting medications down the drain or in the garbage for that matter. And as I mentioned, if we can avoid putting them down the drain, it's better for the environment. We don't want to release these things to the environment. Drugs are wonderful things, but they're meant for the right person at the right time. We don't want to be taking drugs when we're not supposed to. And again, there's more and more studies showing that these things, all kinds of stuff, are ending up in our drinking water, bottled water too. It's not just tap water that we really don't want to be there. So anything we can do as healthcare institutions to avoid that, I think, is extremely important. And because if you, you know, think about it, healthcare is meant to make people healthy. We really want to try and avoid making people sick. I hope so. So comes to, you know, we talked about reduce. I got to speak about reuse, and this is probably the sticky point in healthcare is the use of single-use devices. So I'm working on something in the hospital, just coincidentally. I just found out UHN over a year is using about 80 million different pieces of something throughout the year. 80 million things. That translates to about 21,000 pounds of waste leaving the hospital every single day. So hospitals are very, very well known for having disposable things. Very valid reason. You don't want to be recycling Band-Aids and things like that. I don't think the patients would like that. I don't know why I do this, but there have been, you know, several posts about greening in healthcare and stuff like that and reprocessing single-use devices. And you read some of the reader comments that follow these kind of things, and I don't know why I do this because it just aggravates me, but the public is very wary about these kind of things. The public says, you know, I don't want to reprocess something. There's some high-profile cases where people have, you know, maybe not had things reprocessed properly, and then patients have been exposed. But, you know, there's perception, like hospitals are full of disease, full of sick people. I don't want something that's been used before. But there are potential collaborations, and this is, you know, it's up and coming. So there is something called third-party processing. So what happens is when you have many single-use devices, the person or the company that manufactures it says, this is only valid for a single use, and that's it. There are companies out there that will say, you know what, we'll take that piece of equipment, we'll reprocess it for you, and we'll revalidate it and assume the liability as being sterile. In our experience at UHN, it's really only cost-effective for expensive pieces of equipment. There's nowhere in the Toronto area that does this, as far as I'm certain. We have a central processing department, and we can do stainless steel basins and stuff like that. Laundry department, which can do drapes and those kind of things. But for the expensive catheters and stuff like that, it's only cost-effective if you're doing it for expensive pieces of equipment. So this is something that's up and coming. The latest, most exciting thing is you still have only a choice between disposable and reusable. Now we have something that's called hybrid packs, so a surgical pack or something like that, where you can have the best of both worlds. You can have reusable drapes and gowns and those kind of things and cloths, basins, mixed in with disposable things which you really can't clean properly. And this is relatively new, at least for my perspective. This is something that's up and coming that needs to be considered. So you don't actually have to make a choice of being all disposable or all reusable. There is a happy medium. Really depends on where you are and what's available to your healthcare facility. I kind of touched on this earlier, but under recycling, there's a myth that all hospital waste is infectious. I used to get calls all the time, oh my God, you're poisoning us, you're killing us, and you come down to the dump, you have to see this. And there's been a few masks or gloves mixed in with our paper recycling, right? All hospital waste is not infectious. There is a big ick factor. Sure, all waste has to be handled with routine precautions, but hopefully when people are handling garbage anyway, garbage is gross to start with, is, you know. But only a small amount requires special disposal. So that really, comes up to lesson learned. We really have to be proactive, health infection control, working with environmental services to educate our staff and also the people outside the hospital who are handling your waste, right? There's a recycling company. They have people, you know, they may be transient workers or people, you know, they're not making a career out of handling garbage necessarily, and they need to be educated to know that just because it's coming from a hospital doesn't mean you're at increased risk for infection. As a matter of fact, many of the stuff we have coming out of the operating room is probably cleaner than most household garbage. It's sterile, right? It hasn't come in touch with the patient. So when you're doing this, you need to make sure you have a good understanding of your legal requirements and your local requirements. You know, what does the city require? What does your garbage hauler require? Similarly, there's a myth, and this is coming up more in the greening side, where people say, you know, we want to recycle cans and bottles, but infection control won't let us because it attracts bugs. Well, the fact of the matter is that it's not the recycling that attracts the bugs. It's the cans and bottles that are attracting bugs if they're not cleaned up properly. You know, you have your milk or your chocolate milk or your soda pop or whatever, and there's a little bit left over. Sweet, good food for bugs. So the reality is it's garbage no matter if it's recycled, sorted into two bins, five bins, one bin. It's the garbage itself, if it's not handled properly, can attract the bugs. So good housekeeping is key. Regular pickup of waste, making sure it's being picked up regularly. And if you're doing something that's got liquid in it, line your bags, line your bins with clear bags so your cleaners are not spending days and days and days washing off, Coca-Cola or Pepsi or whatever from our recycling bins. Similarly, there's the myth that we can't recycle in our ORs or the ICUs. There's too many infection control requirements out there. Sure, we shouldn't be bringing cardboard into our operating rooms. But you know what? Again, much of the stuff is very, very clean. Sterile water bottles, all kinds of stuff coming out. The blue wraps, these things are very, very clean. If you're able to recycle them in your jurisdiction, there's no reason you shouldn't be doing it. We're finding that a lot of the nurses and actually some of the physicians are really interested in recycling. They will take the time to, take the extra two steps and recycle something along the way. So, again, just another myth we've encountered along the way. So those are the kind of some of the details that come up. But again, what the key thing is at least what I've found, is creating a clean and green culture. So it really gets down to, and I didn't see Dr. Garvin's presentation before, but I've heard him speak. The key is, how do we get staff to do what they already know they should be doing, right? So is it hand washing, hand hygiene? Is it turning off the lights and recycling? And I'm happy to say that whether it be infection control, which is UHN, they've gone the route of positive deviant, or energy environment, we've kind of done our own homegrown version of positive deviant. We have arrived at the same conclusion. It really is creating a culture, and it really is supporting each other. So the important thing, I think, in terms of collaboration is to talk, listen, and learn. With a bit of tongue in cheek, on the clean side, learn what your hospital's green goals are, right? What does the hospital want to do in terms of greening? And then once you've learned them, don't pretend that you know what your hospital's green goals are. If you have a green person there, ask them. They're the expert. That's their job. Similarly, if I have an infection control question, I'm going to ask infection control. So I may be at a design meeting and our infection control person can't make it to that meeting for whatever reason. And I said, it's not my area of expertise, but I think we need a different design for a sink. Or I think we might need a hand washing sink there. We need to contact infection control. It really is working together, especially when I speak about greenwashing. More and more products will have the claim of green there. If you have an environmental resource or something like Practice Green Health, a lot of web resources to see if these environmental claims are valid, right? You don't want to be buying something just because it has a green claim. It may not necessarily be better for the environment. The great example I have is PostSARS. I got a phone call from someone. They had a great product for me. It was going to really help with infection control. Disposable phones. So... yeah, believe it or not. So as soon as I got this stuff, I actually called up Karen from Infection and Control. I said, please tell me you're not considering disposable phones. And she said, not a chance. And we talked about it. And it really wasn't concerned. So it really was the talk, listen, and learn, supporting each other. We're small departments. So the key of the hospital is patient care, taking care of patients. It's going to be our nurses, our doctors. We have the most prominent, but we support each other and make sure we know kind of what, I want to make sure I kind of know what infection control is talking about, what their concerns are, so I can vouch for them, I can point them in the right direction, I can give them a call and say, I think we have an infection control issue here, you better check it out. I get the calls all the time saying we have a potential green product or we have a potential issue here, I think you better check it out. And it works very well, and it's really the highlight of it, what I'm discussing today is the collaboration. So with that in mind, I do have to thank Karen Stockton, who's the Director of Infection Control at our hospital at UHN, and Dr. Susie Hoda, who's the Medical Specialist in Infection and Prevention Control. We've worked in presentations before. I did have them vet this presentation to make sure I kind of knew what I was talking about in the infection control side of things. But it just shows, many of our goals are similar. Many of the ways we work, the challenges we have are similar. Our frustrations are similar. There's really no reason why we have to make it a clean versus green. It can be clean while green. So... I'll encourage people to get in touch with me if you don't have greening resources in your area. And I think here we have time for a few questions now. I see the yellow light, so thank you.
Thank you, Ed. We do have time for just a few questions. If people could actually come up to the mic so that the people on the teleclass will be able to hear, that would be great. And it is right before lunch, so I do have just a couple of quick announcements. Heather Hall, you are the winner of the indoor exercise bar, and you can pick that up at the Remington booth during lunch. I think we have a question. Marion.
Hi, Ed. Thanks so much for your presentation. Yesterday, Dr. Conley mentioned that the that in Alberta they had decided not to use the electronic eye for the hand washing stations, and that they went with the foot controls. So you're saying that the hand, the electronic eye, is indeed better, or?
Do you know what? I don't have to. I think the key is hands-free. In our hospitals, our facilities and our housekeeping don't like the foot pedals in some areas because at maintenance, they break down more often than the electronic eye in their experience. Also, more difficult to clean, to get a mop or something in between. So we have both. But, you know, from our facilities department, the people who have to maintain these things, they do like the electronic eye. So there's no, in my mind, there's no best practice. The best practice is really hands-free. So whatever works for the institution is best.
Okay. We were going to some new facilities, so it's good to hear that. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
Did you say what your suggestions are for disposing of IV fluids and antibiotics other than putting them down the sink?
No, I didn't.
I thought I might have missed it.
We're just in the process at UHN of putting a new system in place where we're able to capture these things, a special bin meant just for pharmaceutical waste. We're not the first institution to do it, but we're leading bleeding edge in many ways. And it's a practice change. It's work. So, but that really is the best practice. If you go to the States where these things are sometimes more highly regulated, you can get fancy bins. There's kind of like anti-pixes where you can scan your medication and it opens up the appropriate bin. What we've chosen to do at UHN is consider all drug waste, throat lozenges, antibiotics, whatever, as pharmaceutical waste. Put it in the same bin, narcotics, everything, and dispose of it as pharmaceutical waste. We're just rolling it out right now. Actually, back at the office is happening as I speak, I hope so.
We've been doing that with pill-type things or small liquid bottles going back to pharmacy, but I haven't actually thought about the liquids from the IV bags before, and that could be, I can't imagine a bin sitting on the ward with the liquid brewing, so I'm just trying to imagine if there are actually systems for that.
You know, when we looked at it, we found that there's not actually, there's a lot of volume that's being pumped into patients, but not necessarily a lot that's being disposed of. Mm-hmm. So ideally, if those bags can be sealed before being put in the bin, that's great.
And then just go back to the pharmacy and they have ways of disposing
well,
of them?
Well, the bins, actually, our pharmacy doesn't want open medications coming back because they're for infection control reasons.
Right.
So the thinking is that the whole bin with the pills and the closed IVs and expelled syringes and ampules and stuff like that will get picked up and be disposed of as pharmaceutical waste. Mm.
Okay, thank you.
And with very little cost impact. I mean, there is a bit of a cost impact because the drain is largely free, but especially for, you look at the overall cost of the hospital, very, very low cost impact.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Ed, for a very different topic. My question is with regard to the HVAC in the OR. I think that would be a very easy fix to save some money for the energy consumption of the hospital. And I wonder what kind of mechanism you have in place to ensure that OR is flicked on in the morning when the OR begins, or what period of time you need to fire up that OR ventilation system before the OR cases actually begin.
Good question. So the key is actually in the design of the system, and it's called the building automation system and something called zone control. So ideally, you can control each OR by itself without creating negative and positive pressure problems in the OR. And you can schedule each OR on its own. So most operating rooms are scheduled, right? So I think we have something like 40 at UHN. A large majority, when that operating room is going to be used, so you can schedule to turn it on in advance. You can schedule to turn it off, a certain time afterwards. You can also put in manual override, so someone could, if they need something in an emergency situation, just say, we'll have a few operating rooms which are set aside for emergency situations. If you need another one, press a button, it'll get things operating. But the key is in the design, actually. It's very difficult to go in, not difficult, very expensive to go in afterwards and do it. But if you can design it properly and have that capability, then it's very cost effective. And just program it in. And that's again collaboration. Making sure that your environmental services or your facilities people are speaking with the clinical people, knowing which ORs and when.
Knowing which weekend is ortho on call weekend.
Exactly.
Like
exactly.
That. Okay.
And a modern building automation system is very flexible. You can have special dates and special schedules and things like that. Very, very flexible.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Okay, so I guess that's it. With one last plug for infection control for me before Sahir, I guess for lunch, wash your hands, please. And thank you.